Good morning, everyone. Monday, May 18th, the start of another week of war. And here are news reports by our staff correspondents covering developments on important fronts. We take you first to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The German cruiser Prince Eugen has slipped out of Trondheim Fjord on the Norwegian coast. She'd been in Trondheim since she escaped up the channel from Brest with the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. British reconnaissance planes spotted the Eugen yesterday heading south along the Norwegian coast. She was evidently making her way back to a German dockyard to repair the damage caused weeks ago by a torpedo from a British submarine. The RAF sent out a strong force of Beauforts, Hudsons, Blenheims, and Bowfighters. They attacked the Prince Eugen during the night near the southern tip of Norway. First reports indicate she was hit by torpedoes from Beauforts. She was escorted by four destroyers and formations of fighters. During a big air battle, the Bowfighters raked the decks of the destroyers with cannon fire. Five Messerschmitt fighters were destroyed and others damaged. The British lost nine planes. Some time ago, photographs had shown the Prince Eugen's stern aground in Trondheim. Canadian air crews last night flew American-built Boston bombers to attack German airfields in Holland. RAF formations have been over France today. British opinion at the moment seems fairly optimistic about the coming months. According to the latest British Institute of Public Opinion poll published in the London News Chronicle, 41% of the British people believe the Allies can defeat Germany this year. 40% don't think so, and 19% said they didn't know. Asked how Britain can best help defeat Germany this year, 36% said open up another front, develop an offensive somewhere. 15% said help the Soviet Union in every way we can. 13% said increase the weight of the British bombing offensive against Germany. Sir Stafford Cripps told a meeting of his constituents yesterday that the government is keen and anxious for a second front. He said the only difference between the government and the people was that the people could talk about a second front and the government couldn't. Cripps declared the Germans are uneasy at the militant offensive spirit of the British and American peoples. And he said they will show something more than nervousness when our two governments translate that militant spirit into offensive action, as they certainly will at the moment they judge opportune. Sir Stafford also seems to have taken a crack at the fuel rationing dispute that forms Britain's chief internal problem. Sir Stafford warned Britain that if once the nation were to permit a single vested interest to oppose or hinder the war drive, it would have to give way to every other selfish demand that might be made in the country. Political observers believe Cripps favors state control of the coal industry as a means of solving the shortage. The government had a coupon rationing plan, but opposition by backbench conservatives kept it from being put into effect. The conservatives are fighting the nationalization of the industry that labor leaders want. Under the labor scheme, the industry would be run by a committee representing the government, owners, and miners. One scheme reported to have been put forward by the conservatives and coal owners is that the government take a lease on the mines during the war and guarantee the owners fixed profits. The whole controversy is due to get a public airing when Parliament meets again. And unless the government can think up something that will make both parties happy, the session may be a fiery one. Because the average man knows there's plenty of coal in Britain, and if he has to shiver next winter, he wants to be sure that everyone else is shivering too. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
For the news of the fighting along the Russian front, we hear from Robert Magadoff in Moscow. His report reaches us through the newsroom in San Francisco.
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. Marshal Timoshenko's drive on Kharkov has assumed the speed and force of an avalanche. Hitler is trying desperately at least to slow down the advance of the Red Army and has brought up fresh troops, some who were stationed in Paris only 2 weeks ago. He is throwing more and more tanks and more frequent counterattacks. He's attaching armored trailers to his tanks to carry infantry into the very midst of Soviet soldiers. He is sending wave after wave of his latest dive bombers to support action of the Reichswehr. Finally, he is pouring numerous groups of parachutists into the rear of Timoshenko's troops, but all in vain. The Russians have gotten over whatever tankophobia ever possessed them. Hatred for the Germans has proved greater than fear of their tanks. By now, Hitler has lost nearly 500 tanks in this battle. Parachutists are being hunted down and wiped out like pests. and Soviet aces have proved more than a match for Hitler's airmen. The net result is that the battle is steadily nearing Kharkov and Krasnograd. Moscow, in the meantime, is thoroughly enjoying the first warm days of this year's late spring. All the city parks yesterday celebrated their official opening. I went to the Central Park of Culture and Rest, which I can best describe to you as a sort of subdued Coney Island. The crowds were gay and teeming. Girls wore brightly colored dresses and were laughing happily, as do girls all over the world on a warm evening in May. For the breath of war was felt even here. The parachute tower and other militarized attractions were doing a brisk business. The stands scattered all over the park, men and women were instructing anyone willing in the handling of a rifle, a tommy gun, and even a heavy machine gun, or how to put on a gas mask. Goodbye from Moscow.
And now from San Francisco, we take you to the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky, somewhere in Australia. Again, there is only slight air activity. That is yesterday's unsuccessful Jap raid on Port Moresby to report on all the great Southwest Pacific area. Certainly today's Church Street Line official communique gives no indication of what every competent observer here feels is only a phony interlude of comparative peace before what history may record as one of the war's great battles. Tokyo Radio reports a strong American naval force has been sighted east of the Solomons and steaming westward. It's not my intention to inform the Japs if they're right or wrong. BC Francis Radio reports a large Japanese fleet is now in the waters north of Australia. The Japs, French stooges, are also entitled to their own opinion. What we all feel here is that the coming trial of strength in the Southwest Pacific may be nearer than a surface reading of the official communiques may indicate. Side by side with this belief in the imminent and critical nature of our coming clash with the Japs, there is cropping up again the fear that the dangerous nature of the Jap threat to Australia is again being underestimated in London and in Washington. Naturally, the gigantic war in Russia has pulled the eyes of all the world away from this area. Certainly, it might even be stupid to place the importance of this theater on a par with that of Russia. But looking at the war from Australia's threatened coasts, it's hard for us here to take our eyes away from the Jap invasion force looming up just over our own horizon. The first official report of U.S. naval activities, published yesterday in Washington, did not make for very happy reading here. One of its sentences in particular is being dissected with the utmost care by responsible observers in this country. It read, I quote, "Sound military policy requires the concentration of all available resources for the main effort, while there must be the maximum economy of forces in the secondary theaters," unquote. Written in Washington, the large strategic picture may be clear enough. Read in Australia, this sentence condenses into one unhappy question. It's this: is Australia one of the secondary theaters to which Washington's report refers? Sir Keith Murdoch, Australia's most influential and responsible editorialist, evidently has reason to fear Australia is in the secondary theater category. Writing in tonight's Melbourne Herald, Sir Keith first lambasts the British for the obstinate overconfidence which produced the disastrous quartet of Hong Kong, Malaya, Java, and Burma. Then of Washington he writes, I quote, "Overconfidence there has been just as pronounced, perhaps more pronounced. President Roosevelt's statement in his April broadcast that there is good reason to believe the Jap southward advance has been checked was only symptomatic of an optimism that has obstinately colored Washington thinking about the Western Pacific. The view is seriously wrong. We must get it into the minds of Washington authorities that airplanes and ships in much greater quantities are needed," unquote. I know it must be terribly confusing to the American public following the dispatches of correspondents from all the theaters of this war to distinguish among the published yells of help, murder, police from Burma, from England, from Russia, from China, the false notes of the boys who are just crying wolf and those who are desperately fighting the wolf at the door. I've yelled myself from the doorsteps of Greece, of Malaya, and of Java. And each time, unhappily, the wolf really was at the door. Tonight, I want to yell for help again from Australia in the firm conviction that once more, the form of the wolf, the Jap wolf, is at this continent's door. This is Martin Agronsky returning now to San Francisco.
And now for the report of Earl Godwin speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. I have to start off this morning's little talk with you by telling you of the death of a gentleman that has had a great part in this program from me to you. That was Representative Patrick J. Boland, of Pennsylvania, who's known as the Democratic House Whip. That is an officer of the Democratic Party of the House. He went home to take part in the exciting Pennsylvania primary. He was running for re-election, and he apparently died from heart stroke. I say he had a part in this program from me to you because it was daily contact with Pat Boland and the leaders of the majority and minority and the Speaker of the House and the Vice President and Senator Barkley, which makes up ordinary the package of news that comes from that end of the Capitol in Washington. And many a time have I been able to give to you folks, good folks who are listening, just a little advance notice because I used to cling right close to Pat Boland and his crowd. That's going to cast a gloom over the Congress today, but I must hurry along and tell you that you don't have to be an expert to analyze today's news, and I don't hold myself up as any expert at all, but this is the housewife's big day. It's the day that marks the beginning of the time when the government's going to stand by you folks and try to stop the rising cost of living. At least that's their intention. That's what they say. The prices on all the things you buy, with inconsequential exceptions, are going to roll back today to where they were March 15. And on about 170 of life's necessities, the man is expected to have the March 15 prices printed or chalked or painted in letters and figures large enough for you to read from where you're standing in the store. No typewritten lists under the counter or books to be hunted up and studied. It has to be there like the handwriting on the wall or like those figures in the eye doctor's office so that he who buys may read. This day then marks the start of the government's great experiment in trying to stall the rising cost of living, which has been advancing at a rate which the government here expresses it at 1.5% a month. It has pegged costs at the start, the mines, the factories, the wholesalers, and now at the counter where the public buys. But the X quantity is wages, which are not pegged and which are rolling around as liquid and as hard to freeze as quicksilver. Many people believe it is as hard to peg and stop the rising cost of living without freezing wages as it would be to spell the word Tommy without a T. Senator George of Georgia says the experiment will succeed or fail within 3 months, and that if it fails, Congress must freeze the wages. Meantime, the President and the Secretary of Agriculture, Wickard, seem to have reached an agreement with the all-powerful farm bloc so that some of the vast surpluses of grain, wheat especially, can be let out on the market. Otherwise, there will be no place to store the oncoming wheat crop, so they say. Also, letting out the stored-up grain is expected to prevent runaway prices on meat and dairy products. You can fuss and fume all you want about gas rationing. Your government, speaking through the Office of Emergency Management, says that if you don't conserve your car and tires and gasoline, you may have none of them. You won't get any more car or tires this year anyhow, maybe not next year. And the modern Jeremiah, speaking for the government at the Office of Emergency Management, says American civilization is going on wheels, and if it doesn't look out, it may go to ruin on foot. And that's all from Washington at this time.
These have been reports by John McVane in London, Robert Magadoff in Moscow, Martin Agronsky in Australia, and Earl Godwin in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.